then was both, was as a way to show your opposition.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
But you still felt the children were too young for you to be too active yet or not?
Well, I couldn't accept any position, you know, that I would have to do. Now, see, now for instance, when from 19, Carol Jean was born in 1925, my youngest. Now, but from 1921 we came to California, and we were moving around from one place to there so much that it really was very hard, almost impossible, to really be very active and everything. And there was no sense of belonging when you couldn't do anything. Whenever there was a picket line, I went to it anyway. But you see, it's a little different that when you're in an organization, for instance, you distribute leaflets, you go and speak when you have to. The first time that I ever spoke to a group like that was when I had been arrested in 1929, I guess it was, or 1930, that time when we protested. This was a labor organization, you know. And when they asked me to speak before a Young Women's Christian Association meeting, I said, oh, no, I'm not a speaker. I don't want to. They said, you don't have to be a speaker to tell them just what happened and why you were there. And he said, you can't refuse to do that. That's all that, and everything. So, you know, I really suffered. I had to get up there before them. And Carol Jean at that time, I think she was about 3 years old, I grasped her hand and went up the platform, and I looked at that sea of faces. I thought, what do I say? And suddenly I remembered the guy who said, what do you do when he said he went to jail rather than he didn't believe in taxation without representation. And so the first thing I said, you know, as I came here and wanted to speak to you, I really have trembled because I'm not a speaker. But then I thought, I am a human being, and so are you. And I thought of what Thoreau said when he was in jail and when Emerson came to see him. Now, Emerson is a very smart man. He was not only a great writer, he was a great man. And when he said, what are you doing here? And then Henry said to him, what I want to know is what you're doing out there when you don't take a stand against this. So, and to my surprise, they applauded. Well, then I felt more at home, you know, because I had made a nothing.
What group was it you were speaking for?
Young Women's Christian Association.
But were you speaking for the Communist Party?
Was speaking for the Socialist Party, really.
Mm-hmm.
More for the Socialists than for the Communists.
Mm-hmm.
And also for the labor group, because I was arrested on the... Because we were protesting what was happening to labor guys,
mm-hmm.
Archie Brown and Edgar Owen.
But you were not a member of the union. It was to support the union.
That's right. That's right. It was to support the union. And so then I told them, you know, I've been told, did you ever see really a policeman attacking anyone? Did you see a policeman? Because you think of the policeman as your guardians. You know, we call on them when we're in trouble and everything. And I will never be one of those that just there because I think that the police are also the victims of this kind of a system. But I think, unless you were involved in something, why would you see a policeman strike at anyone or anything? You wouldn't unless you were involved in the struggle where you would see it. I had never seen it until I joined this group of fighting against it. And whenever you see injustice, well, isn't it your duty to? See, I'm not religious, but after all, if you don't do the things to do to others as you would have them do to you, and what is there more important than having them do to you that when you're placed in a position that some come to your support? And you have to know what it is. And pretty soon, you know, I said, you know, and none of us, you know, I never dreamt of being in a... I've never been in a jail before. I've read about them, but I haven't been there. And But I could feel very great sympathy with them because I knew there were very few rich people ever in jail. So why is it that only the poor that commit crimes? Or is it only the poor who are caught and everything? Well, before I knew it, you know, see, I spoke a language they understood. So...
Now, this was about 1930?
This is, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll return to that again in next time, maybe. Going back to Denver, so between the time you married in 1907 and 1915, you would go to meetings, but you wouldn't involve yourself in too much else.
No, no. You see, at first, my husband was still even religious. And that just absolutely destroyed me, how anybody... So I said, read the Bible and tell me if you believe in this and this. Well, when he read, he was really appalled. He said, my God, I didn't know this. I said, well, see, you were a blind follower of something you knew nothing whatever about and everything. Then he became more anti-religious, even if it was possible, than I was, you know. He would say, well, read this. Is this what you would support and everything? And then he believed in socialism, but he never became a member and wouldn't join. Because he said once to me, I think I told you that before, he said, look, Karl Marx said, workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. But you have something to lose. I says, what, for instance? He says, well, your son is at the university. You live in a fairly decent home, nothing pretentious or anything, but a comfortable home. But if I lose my job, I says, Joe, I'm only 2 months in advance of what that. Because if you lost your job, your pants are already a little bit, you know, kind of wearing thin. How would you meet the payments on our house? What would you do? I said, so I'm only 2 months in advance of that I carry the red flag, as you call it. I said, and you know, I don't believe in waiting until your pants are down. I believe in, when you know these things are so, you do it to help in that struggle to eliminate it.
How about, what were his attitudes about when you were involved in the anti-war activity around the First World War?
Well, he was scared to death, but then the parentages, when they came over, you know, the president came and told me she admired him and everything. Well, then, you know, it would have been attitude. He thought that I was... You see, we had a poet friend, an Englishman, Dave Perkins. He's the one that he had thought of Jesus as a Jewish labor leader, and that Jesus had a great compassion and everything. When I met David Perkins, I think I was about... I think probably 30 years old at that time, and he was... You know, a poet in his own thing, you know, he lived in Boulder, Colorado, and I have some of his poetry. He wrote beautiful poetry, but unless you have some way of having it printed and everything, very few knew about him. But he admired everything I did. So he called me, when he knew what I had done with Collins, you know, he called me Bravy. And Joe would say, don't always try to be a Bravy, and everything. I said, Joe, I'm not trying to be a Bravy. I'm trying to do the things that a Bravy would do. But I'm not trying to be a Bravy. I don't welcome it. I wouldn't want to go to jail, but if I have to, I would.
Now, when did you move to Fort... You moved to Fort Collins from Denver?
When was what?
You moved from Denver to Fort Collins?
From Denver, we moved to Fort Collins in 1915, we moved to Fort Collins.
Oh, was this what? You joined the Socialist Party first?
No. That's when I heard Kate Richards O'Hare, the most brilliant speaker I ever heard in my life.
She came to Fort Collins?
Yes, she came to Fort Collins and spoke. It was then that I joined the party that I thought that it was shameful, but if I do the rest, then I have to be an organized part of it. And then I joined the Socialist Party. And then I met such wonderful people in Fort Collins. You know, only 10,000 inhabitants at that time there. They had the agricultural college, though. And see, Joe tried to run a little delicatessen store. But we had no experience, and people who were hungry, at that time there was a lot of that, who came in to eat, I let them have food for nothing. Sergio said, look, we can't afford to do that. I said, Joel, you can't refuse to give people food. If you had any other kind of a thing, well, they could go to the Salvation Army and get clothes. But food, how can you refuse to give? But he said, but we can't afford it. I said, then we'd better be out of it, because, you know, even my father, as poor as he was, he never refused food to anybody. How can you refuse food? Well, he helped, but he couldn't. And so in 10 months, we lost everything we had and a lot that we never had. And I had my first experience with a socialist woman. She was 60 years old, and she was supposed to be a cook, you know. She came to our house because of socialists. And she was going to Estes Park, where she was going to work there. And, you know, she was nothing but a thief. First person I, at that time, see, I had a very idealistic idea of a socialist, but a socialist could never do anything to a fellow socialist or to a worker. You know, they all have principles. And when Mrs. Morris, well, she tried to steal $40 from me, and I got it back, but I tell you something. She went to the socialist colony, the first socialist colony in California, what did they call it? It was right here near the, that's the very south from here.
Lano? Huh?
Lano.
Uh-huh.
Lano, she went to Lano. And what was his name, the guy who was in charge of it?
Harriman.
Gib Harriman, right there. And so she had promised that she would be, you know, we were so desperately poor, I can't tell you anything. My brother had been killed just before that and everything. And she had promised that when she was leaving from Chicago with her husband to go to Lano, she would stop off and give me my $40. Well, I stayed up all night waiting for her. She didn't come. So then I wrote to her at Lano, and then I remembered that I had lost $5 in Fort Collins and had looked for it high and low, and I remembered putting it under the table oilcloth there, and she was sewing on the sewing machine. She lived in our house, and I could never find it, and she saw me just frantic about it, you know. Now, you know, anyone would say, what is it, really? But she didn't do a thing, you know. But I didn't connect it. I never thought of anything with her. We let her stay at the store, you know, left her alone with it. Now I know she robbed us blind. So when she didn't come about the 40, that, I'll tell you how that happened sometimes. And so I wrote a postal card to Fort Collins, Lano, and I said, Mrs. Morris, you were a liar and a thief all the time. Now I remember when the $5 were gone, and you sat there sewing, you didn't make any attempt to ask me why. And then when I finally, when I said, oh, my God, and you turned around, then you helped me look, picking up the carpet and everything. But you knew where it was, in your pocket, because you had taken it. You were the only one who was in there. Now I know that that's what you are. So I wrote her and got a postal card. So she wrote me a letter saying that that postal card, it put me in jail, because I'm not to write on a postal card for calling anybody a thief or anything the way I had done. And so Joe said, now, see now. So I went down to the post office, and I got to see one of the top guys there, Charles. I said, look, I wrote a woman. She is a thief. I said, you know, I'll prove it. But she said that I could go to jail because I wrote, and this is what she wrote me. I said, are you going to put me in jail for writing books? He said, well, you know, you're really not allowed to. I said, well, no, I didn't know that, because I'll prove to you that she is. He said, yes, I know that, my dear. But he said, don't worry, I won't put you in jail, but don't do it anymore. Write a letter. I said, but I want the postmaster to read it, to know that. And he said, yes, I gathered as much.
Yeah. Barbara, how long did you stay in Fort Collins then?
Just about a year, perhaps 13 months. We lost everything. We had to go back to Denver.
And then you went back to Denver. And when you were in Fort, up until that time, your husband had been a waiter, and then you decided to open the delicatessen.
He decided to get away from it. For one thing, his feet were killing him, and he hated it, too. He hated taking... You know what he did once? He had worked for a long time at the Adams Hotel, and waiting on a group, you know, about five or six, you know, who were kind of sporty, they'd given him 5 cents for a tip. So he took the 5 cents and said to the busboy, he said, "Here, buddy, this is for you." He threw it to him. And the guy was so angry, you know, showing him up before his friends, that he reported to the management and he lost his job. And Joe said, "Are you sorry?" I said, "No, I'm glad you did it."
Did you have problems supporting the family on his earnings as a waiter?
Oh, yes, we really had problems because we had very little money, and I had, I told you I read Margaret Sanger, mm-hmm. but I had, it seemed to me I was always pregnant. I had 3 children in 2 years and 7 months, I had 3 children, and I couldn't even afford to have, at that time they had a laundry that 1 cent a piece, you know, if you had 50 pieces, so sheets and everything, and I couldn't afford it. So, yeah, we had a hard time.
What kind of housing did you live in?
What kind of, a working class neighborhood. It was kind of nice. I mean, it was a working class, but it wasn't too bad.
Were you in a house or in an apartment?
House.
Uh-huh.
House.
How large was it?
It had 3 bedrooms, and it had no big bathroom, and the people they bought it from had put in a bathroom, taking off part of the kitchen in order to do that. But one of the bedrooms, and I think it helped kill my little girl, was exposed. It was terribly cold there and everything. It was an old house that she had tried to make, and she had lost her... The woman I bought the house from had lost her only 13-year-old daughter to the same thing that my little girl died of, the rheumatic heart.
Mm.
So.
So you were actually buying.
But it was
the
a pleasant. But it was a pleasant house.
You were actually buying the house then.
Oh yes.
I see. And you were able to do that without any problem.
Well, at that time, you know. The payments were about $20 a month. You know, it was just as little as rent would be.
About how much would he make a month? Do you recall?
About how much? I don't think he ever made over $25 a week.
Mm-hmm.
When he made $25, we thought we were lucky.
And then you had to pay about a fourth of what he made for your house in
yes.
the woods. The house already had electricity and everything.
Oh yes.
What was your day like in those?
No, I know. As a matter of fact, I had the electricity put in.
Oh, I see.
Didn't even have electricity. It was a cold chain.
Uh huh. But you had a bathroom inside the house. You didn't have a privy in the back.
No. It was a bathroom inside the house. They had taken a fourth of the kitchen and turned it into a bathroom.
Well, Barbara, in those days, this would be before you, when your children were still young, what was an average day like in your life? Could you run through on
that? Yes, it was hard work. For one thing, having children was so close to a night, you never had a night's sleep, you know, getting up, you were that. 3 babies almost, one was just out of diapers, and that first little girl of mine that died, it wrecked my whole life. Because Helen was just one of the most remarkable little girls. She was in kindergarten, and the kindergarten teacher came to see her when she was still 6. She told me in all the years she had been teaching, she had never met a child so sensitive to others and so bright. So she said, "I never heard a child. She heard a word once, and she was very, very bright."
Now, how old was she when she died?
4 years and 7 months.
And then my son
was the second one. He was born when she was only 15 and a half months when he was born, and he was only not quite, last 4 days of being 16 months when Francis was born.
And what, did you nurse the children?
Yes.
But this didn't prevent you from getting pregnant, nevertheless.
No, it didn't. And, you know, because I had so little rest, my milk wasn't very good either, you know. So Helen had it first in there. I nursed her until she was 8 months old, and she was just as skinny as could be. So the doctor then put her on Horlicks milk, Horlicks malted milk.
I remember the tablet.
Yes. Well, then, and from then on, she gained just remarkably.
Well, then, what would your day be like, say, when you had the three children and they were younger?
What did it be before?
Yeah, when the children were small, what would your day be like? What time?
Well, in the morning, we'd get up because they didn't sleep until after. They would wake up almost with dawn, so it would be about between 6 and 7 o'clock in the morning, and then we were busy cleaning, cooking, washing, sewing. I'd made all the children's clothes. I made everything they wore, and all my own as far as that concerned, and even my mother-in-law's clothes. So it was from, and many times I'd be washing woodwork and everything at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Now, what, your husband worked at night?
Yeah, he worked. He never got home before about 1:30, sometimes almost 2 o'clock, and I was scared to death. Always scared, because there had been many, many burglaries, many murders committed.
Oh, so you were afraid staying alone with the children?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, then he was home during the daytime?
He was home. Well, you see, he had a broken shift. He was home part of the time during the day, but he had to go back. See, that's another thing he didn't like, that it wasn't one shift, but that he would have to go to work sometimes about 8 o'clock in the morning or something, and then he'd be home from 2 o'clock till 5 o'clock, then he had to go back at 5.
When he was home during the day, did he help you with the children or with the housework or anything?
Not very much, because he was sick so much of the time. He had clumsy throat, he had polyps, you know, that had to be operated on. He was sick quite a bit, you know. See, when they had come to Chicago when he was 15 years old, his father had left Hungary about 4 years before. So they didn't come until 4 years later. He left when he was 11. And he put in right away, well, without any training or anything, went to school, night school, for a year or two. He put him in as a waiter. That's how he got the, which he hated, but he never had a chance to acquire any skill in anything. And his father was a would-be baron. You know, you know what a Schauspieler is?
No.
Schauspieler is German for an actor. So he would act once in a while in the German playhouses, but he never got paid for it. Mm-hmm. And he lived on his children, every one of his children. See, Joe was only a little over a year older than Josie, his sister, and then another sister who was 2.5 years older. They worked in the department store as sales girls, and every cent they made, they turned over to that good-for-nothing father. And he had pretension. No Yiddish was ever spoken, wieder nicht, but only Hochdeutsch, you know. Pretensions and everything. And then he once said to me, "Don't I think that the people have to respect their parents, and you have to respect the old?" I says, "No, I don't think anything of the kind. I think the parents, if they merit respect, they'll get the respect. But just the mere fact of being parents doesn't entitle them to respect. And just be old, a cow is old and a horse is old and everything. So do you respect them because they're old? No, you respect them of what they did to deserve that." Oh, he didn't like that, because it was as little as we had, you know, we had to give them some of that.
Oh, so besides supporting you and the children, your husband also helped to support contribute. His parents.
Well, he didn't give very much, but he, $10 a month, if he gave, you know, was a whole lot to him. He had so little, but he did give that.
Now, how about once you were married, what was your relationship like with your own family?
No, my relationship with my family was almost pleasant, but you see, I never forgave my father and mother for not letting me go to school. Always had, so when my mother, you know, when she knew I was a socialist and didn't believe in anything, and she, you know, she felt terrible about it, I said, well, I should, because my father was a reverend, you know, I should, I said, Mama, I owe you nothing. You didn't even let me go to school, so I owe you nothing. I don't have to pretend to about something that I don't believe in, that to me is utter nonsense, just in order to save your feelings. I said, if you had let me go to school, and that's all I asked of you, was to let me go to school, and you wouldn't do it. So I owe you nothing.
Now, is it, Barbara, you mentioned before that you started to use Barbara when you got involved in the socialist movement. Was this in Denver?
No. This was already much later in the Communist Party.
So during those early years in Denver, you still used Beth?
Yes.
I see. So you were known among, in the social group as Beth, too?
Yes.
And when did you start using the name Barbara?
It wasn't really until about 1929 that I... See, it was shortly just when I had been arrested and everything, and Joe really always, he lived in absolute dread that I would be arrested, you know. Mm-hmm. He said, always the baby, you know, oh, he just hated that, you know. And I said, no, it isn't as a baby that I'm arrested, it's only standing up for something that is very fundamental and very necessary for people and everything. So then I took the name Barbara. Well, one of my friends who had been very, very active in New York in the Milk Trust, she was a very beautiful woman. She was 10 years younger than I, and she was 14 or 15 years younger than my son. But she fell in love with my son. And at that time, you know, it was really ridiculous. She was a very beautiful woman. And I learned a lot of things from her because she had been active. She became a social worker here and afterward became a superintendent. So I went with her sometimes to visit her clients and saw what happened, that they would take away even the radio from them. They weren't allowed to have it. Phyllis. Well, see, she and I had been distributing leaflets in Oakland, in Berkeley. And the policeman, I think I told you about that, the policeman came out with, left the gun, and this, remember, was in 1929, so the police, we didn't see the policeman anywhere, we didn't see anybody when we put it on the bench. And he suddenly, there he comes in from nowhere, and he said, did you put those leaflets there? I says, leaflets? What are leaflets? And he said, these. I said, let me see what they are. He said, you know what they are. I said, how can I know what they are if you don't show them to me? I don't know what you're talking about. And Phyllis says, no, officer, I don't know what you're talking about either. What are they? And then he said, well, this, and this, you know, that the workers were having a rally somewhere. And I said, well, what's that about that anyway? I said, you didn't put them there, but anyway, whoever did, what's that about that? But this is a socialist thing. This is a communist thing. I said, well, what's bad about that? He says, I thought you might be one of them. I said, one of what? One of them. I said, well, what's wrong with it? And everything. He said, did you put them there? He said, no. I said, we did not. Are you trying to make a case out of something that isn't so? He says, I make a case out of it. He was so angry. He says, you know I wouldn't do that. I said, I don't know anything of the kind. I think you would. You just look like the kind who would. He said, I ought to run you in. I said, well, why don't you? Oh, he said, I know he muttered under his breath, it would have helped. Not very loud. because he was afraid that you might be the kind, you know, that would know how to make a thing, go to the churches or something, which we sometimes did. As a matter of fact, it was a short time after that that in one of the churches there was a guy, and I've forgotten now his name. He was a very anti-communist, but a very articulate guy, and he had been known all over as a steel pitcher and everything. But he had been a Russian who came here when he was very, very young, and he was a very horrible creature. And in this church, and there was a Finnish woman doctor, Dr. Gengen or something, I forgot now her name, but I liked her very much. And she came to this church to help us. We were raising money then for Soviet, for the Soviet Union, and to bring speakers over. And this guy had talked about everything. And I said, now look, Dr. whatever her name was, you, after all, you are Finnish, but you know all of the Russian history. And you know this man is a liar and that he is faking this thing. Will you come there and speak up and stand up? He says, I sure will. She had an awful lot of guts. Believe me, there were others who knew as much as she and didn't risk it. And she came there. And when he was talking that, I said, you know, her first name was Olga. Did you be called up? You know, when he began speaking, she got right up there and she says, you are a liar. I have all the things that you're talking about that time that they did have, that this was, they were starving because there was a famine there, and you say that they were withholding food. You are a liar, and I will prove it. And you, I know the mentor. And this guy just got scared to death. He just absolutely collapsed. And this was in a church, too. And the minister, who had not been for us, but not against us either, he came out and he says, I'd like to know something more about that and everything. And he said to this guy, I said, I don't know whether to call the police or just boot you out of here. He said, don't call the police. So he left it that same night. He left and everything. But, you know, the people, some of the people like this Finnish doctor, were such remarkable people, you know, that though many people were afraid to say anything, here you found people who really, you were surprised, had the courage to come and speak up and take the stand.
Barbara, going back then again, before you joined the support, in Fort Collins, when you were there, was there a fairly large group of socialists there?
Yes, there were. Yeah, although this was only 10,000 people there at that time, there was quite a large group of socialists. Some of the one that I'll never forget their name, George Charette, he was French origin, but they were real comrades. They catered to their hair, stayed at their house, and everything. You never heard a magnificent speaker like Kate Richard Hill. She was arrested after about the war protesting, you know, and wrote a book.
Was this at a rally about the war that you heard her speak?
No, this was at a meeting that where she spoke, was that everyone had to be aware of what was happening and know what the socialists stood for and everything. This was in 1915, when the First World War had started there. And she told us things about what were happening here, and what they were doing to the IWW, and what they were doing to the socialists here. But she was a magnificent speaker.
And
she was also one of the founders of LAMO.
Oh, she was? I didn't know.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
But she never lived there, did she?
She spoke there. She would go there quite often. I'm not sure that she ever lived there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure of that. They call that paper they put out the rickshaw.
You know,
do you remember that, Dorothy? The rickshaw, the paper to go here, they put out the socialist paper, LAMO, the rickshaw.
Yes, I do.
There was also another YALMO group in Louisiana.
Yes, when they went there, see, the war destroyed this one here because they wouldn't sell to them. They had nothing to sell because they wouldn't sell to them and they wouldn't anything. Then, of course, they found out, just like I found out that Mrs. Morris was the son of a ditch hypocrite. They found out, too, that many who came to Llano really didn't want to work or do anything. They were really spongers.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing and the other helped us out. Then they went from there
Louisiana, there was somewhere.
Then they made peanut butter. They tried to salvage the peanut crop, you know, and revive the economy of the South with the peanuts.
I'll bring you, can you read regular prints, or you can only read the large prints?
Well, I have some reading. I'm interested. By the way, I told you that when this happened, I had written to Job Harriman. You know, Job Harriman was a wonderful guy. I wrote and told him all about Mary Morris, but again, I got a letter from him, a very nice letter. He says, you know, it's very unfortunate that we have some people who should have integrity who have none, even though they call themselves socialists. Mm. But he says, look, my dear, there's very little I can do about a thing like that. What can I do? Arrest her or what? There's very little. But anything I can do, I'll be very glad to do it because I hate things like that and everything. So I wrote and told him about what she had written about, that I could be arrested by the post office and everything. He says, well, I doubt very much that they'll arrest you for it, but it really is supposed to be against the law.
But they let her stay in community. She was not removed from the community then.
She was removed because they removed themselves. That when the war started, it just simply died.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen it, but Lulu McCormick, a friend of mine, and we had friends in it. This must be about 10 years ago. We went to Lancaster because Lana was near Lancaster there, and I saw for the first time the hitching post. And they still had things of that were part of Llano.
Oh, and that's the first time you've been out there, though?
Yes, first time.
Well, when you formed...
But I knew many people who went there.
In 1919, when you formed that communal living group, were you attempting to create a whole community, or was it...
No, there were just three families of us, and it was a dismal failure.
Did you have any ideology about it when you created this?
Well, I thought I did. I thought that communal living must be very wonderful, very good, but I found that the weaknesses there didn't overcome, you know, and there were very few. You see, they were all products also of the capitalist system, and although in one breath, you know, they were supporting socialist ideals and everything, but this wasn't geared for that. And so I had four children, and they and the Hannons, Dr. Hannon, they had four children. Helen and Will didn't have any children at all, Helen and Will Dietrich, but they had brothers and sisters who always came and stayed there and everything. But anyway, it just didn't work at all. And the children fought.
Huh? Was this a farm, or was it...
No, it was a kind of a little ranch, big, little with an awful little L, very little. The main thing that they did is plant celery and learn how to take care of it, you know, because celery bought a big price then.
How many acres did they plant, do you recall?
There was only 1 acre.
And was the idea to make a living off of it, or did they...
No, it's a supplement. Not to make a living, but a supplement.
So the people still held jobs on the outside?
Oh, yes.
And did you have any ideas about how you would all relate to each other's children?
No, we never had any idea what had happened. Dorothy and Irene Hannon, Irene was about a few months older than Dorothy. They fought like hell about things because they simply took a small house there and said this was their headquarters. Then there was a big building in which we had a bedroom and everything. And so when Dorothy said, well, if this belongs to all of us, and she wanted She said, no, it doesn't. This is our house and you get out. And when Dorothy refused, she picked up a knife, I think, and hit her. And she came out crying to me and naming. And I said, don't come crying to me. Pick up anything you can and let Irene have it. And she said, well, you're teaching her to fight. She said, I don't do that. I said, you don't have to. They do it without your teaching.
But so the two families remained as three separate family units, really.
Well, no, we were all together. We ate together, and we shared. We paid everything together, you know, on an equal basis. But it was really not an ideal arrangement. It really wasn't.
Do you think Cook had planned well enough? Or
well, there's no planning about it. It was the 1919 world. Then we were on the adjacent street. Yeah, with the Haddons and the Dietrichs and us.
You mean the colony?
Yeah. We called it the colony. You remember that. Well, was it an ideal arrangement? Well, you know, when we moved away, when we bought a house and moved away, I had such a feeling of freedom. I felt as if whereas, like in Christian felt, you know, when his burden fell off of him, I felt as if I were relieved of a burden.
Well, did the group ever analyze what went wrong?
I don't think we did. We just got sick and tired of it. And the ones who got the most of it had very little money. They only had $100 to put into the whole thing. We put $500 into it, and the Dietrichs put almost as much, $300 or $400 in it. But yet, and the Dietrichs had a few chickens, and you know, well, feed was very high. Not the only one who had any of the eggs were the Hannons. None of us ever touched an egg. But yet they cooked about the price of the feed and everything. So we were aghast, you know. I thought, look, they're the only ones who benefit from it. Yet they cook about the price of feed, but they get all the other things, you know, and they're not putting in their fair share of it. So that is also a sort of thing, you know. That
was it openly discussed?
I don't think so. I don't think it was ever openly discussed.
I think outside of Mr. Hannon, he didn't have this kind of showed him any feeling of. It was really was not a feeling of community identity. All I can remember about it is the social Sunday school that was right here. Who taught that?
Well, the Sunday school wasn't here there. We had to go way over to Ball Heights.
Who taught the social Sunday school?
Dr. Hannon. And they had me teach it too, but I didn't know what to teach them. All I could tell them, look, I didn't know a damn thing about it. I just told them, look at its animals. Animals wouldn't allow one to go ahead and feast and let the other starve. They'd go into debt first. And look at in with human beings, they do, because they don't have enough sense to organize. Really, I didn't do a big job because I didn't know enough.
Well, Barbara, why did you decide to form the colony?
Well, we met them in a socialist meeting, and Dr. Hannon had run away from the South. He had been imprisoned, as I understood it, that he was teaching socialism. He was a high school teacher, and he was also a doctor. We all thought that he believed in food. They ate raw oatmeal, no cooking, with milk. And Joe tried to eat it too, you know. And he went into a restroom and he ordered raw oatmeal. He says, so the guy said, raw oatmeal for a horse without milk. And we didn't like their, see, they believed in a certain food things that none of us really cared much about. And he was a good cook, you know.